Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil, broadcasting remotely. Town leaders and Connecticut residents have been following the latest number of COVID-19 cases in our state and whether the positivity rate or community spread of the virus is on the rise. These data points are important in congregate settings too, like nursing homes, state psychiatric facilities, and in prisons. Today, Where We Live, we talk about COVID-19 with Angel Quiros, the commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Correction. He's worked his way up in the DOC from correctional officer to warden and most recently as deputy commissioner of operations and rehabilitative services before being named interim DOC commissioner this summer after Roland Cook left. Last month, Governor Lamont nominated Quiros to be the commissioner of the agency. The Connecticut General Assembly is expected to take up his nomination during its regular session starting in January. Now, have you or someone you know had experience inside one of the state's correctional facilities? What questions do you have for DOC Commissioner Quiros? You can join us, 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WMPR. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome Angel Quiros to our show. Again, he's Commissioner Designate of the Connecticut Department of Correction. Commissioner Quiros, welcome to Where We Live.
Good morning, Lucy. Thank you for having me.
I want to jump right in because we know COVID is on the minds of many of us. I understand just last week, I believe, Connecticut prison officials were monitoring a coronavirus outbreak in Hartford Correctional Center where 56 incarcerated people tested positive but not showing symptoms, according to one of your spokespersons for the Department of Correction. And I wanted to start there. When we hear about the second wave starting in our state, what are you doing to help prevent more cases within our prison system?
So before I start, I just want to make sure that say thank you to Governor Lamont for giving me this opportunity to be the commissioner, next commissioner of correction. As far as COVID-19, the second wave, you are correct. We had an incident probably 2 weeks ago at ACC where a staff member who was positive via contact tracing, we were able to go into the dorms and do mass testing of two dorms, and 56 individuals came back asymptomatic. Mm-hmm. We immediately went to our phase three lockdown of the COVID operation plan. No visits, no contractors, no volunteer, just strictly the correctional staff that are assigned to that facility. It is our priority is to make sure that once that spread is identified, that we do everything we can to contain the spread. The difference between the first wave and second wave, of course, is the PPE. Back on the first wave in March, for example, we had 3,500 N95 masks. Last week, the last inventory numbers that we had was over 100,000 MP95 masks. So the PPE for the staff is there, for the inmate population is there. Got to make sure that we stay on top of the cleanliness of the facility, the cells, the dorms, the hallways, anything an offender or staff member could place their hands on. The mask, the big difference this second time around is going to be the mask testing. As you know, or may not know, we just completed the third round of staff testing. We're in the middle of a third round of offender testing. We will start the fourth round of staff testing on October 28th, which I believe is this Thursday. And as soon as we finish the third round with the inmate population, we will be going right back in and start the fourth round. There's also a mass testing going on at each facility if an offender is going to transfer from one facility to another. Within 72 hours, that offender has to be tested and the result has to be rendered. Anytime an offender is being sent out into the community, for a visit to the hospital sites, there's a COVID test. And anytime we're releasing an offender, whether it's EOS or to halfway house or transitional placement out in the community, there's testing that's conducted on the offenders. So I am confident that the mass testing and the amount of testing that we do will identify those hot zones real quick, and then sending our resources to the problem to try to contain it.
Commissioner, going back to the masks, who is mandated to wear masks within a correctional facility?
So staff members are mandated to wear masks, and the EMA population are mandated to wear masks, and that's by the executive order from the from Governor Lamont. Within that executive order, it does have a verbiage that if an individual is able to social distance, that he or she does not have to wear the mask. I prefer for our staff and the EMA population to wear the mask at all times. But those are the individuals that are mandated to wear the mask.
You said that you prefer that staff and inmates wear them at all times, but are there instances where staff within your prisons are not wearing the mask? Is that problematic if they're going in and out back to their homes and then coming back into your facilities?
It's not just the staff members not wearing the mask. It's the offender population also not wearing the mask. There has been incidents where our staff member and our inmate population is not wearing the mask. And it's like a weekly, daily reminder when I communicate to the leadership team, my leadership team, and when we're communicating with the young wardens at the facility, that this is a top priority, that it has to be addressed daily from shift to shift, hour to hour, with both the staff and the inmate population. I have seen, just like out in the community, COVID fatigue, mass fatigue. We've been at this since March. So there's some fatigue. And I would say that the inmate population has been very helpful and cooperative, and so has those correctional officers and correctional staff that come into these correctional facilities, because they're just as concerned as anybody else, concerned as the inmate population. At the end, they got to go home to their loved ones too. And so they're doing everything they can to prevent the spread from the disease. But there is some fatigue. And we have, as a commissioner, I have to acknowledge that, because it is happening out in the community also, and just continue to reinforce the importance of social distancing, the importance of wearing the mask in order to stop the spread.
I imagine it's difficult to have social distancing in a prison. You have only so much space. I'm just curious, when you say that you continue to work with your staff and inmates to battle COVID fatigue, so to speak, some of the challenges of that, Commissioner.
There's always going to be a challenge in the correctional setting. I think the challenge that we faced back in March 2020, the first wave, was a lot harder. As I look at the second wave, it's a lot harder because there was more offenders. When I looked at the count this morning, we had a little bit over 9,300. Since March 1st to Friday, last Friday, we've released over 4,301 offender out into the some form of supervision. We sent 1,646 offenders out on transitional supervision. That means that offender had an approved sponsor, an approved home to go to. So those individuals are out in the community. We sent another 1,416 into the halfway house release. So they went from a facility to a halfway house. And then we went into the halfway house and we looked for individuals, number one, that were working, had stable employment, and number two, had a sponsor out in the community. We've moved 1,242 out into the community. And then based on my statutory power that I have, I've granted 299 90-day reentry furloughs. So that has helped us with spacing, and particularly the dorm settings. The three facilities that remain to be a challenge with the dorm settings are the county jails, and that's the uncensored population. That we have, and we're looking right now, we're probably like at 85% capacity in those dorms. We're looking to try to mirror what we've done in the census dorms, where if we drop that population probably by 50% to have more space to social distance with the inmate population and staff.
You're hearing Commissioner Angel Quiros. He leads the State Department of Correction here in Connecticut. If you have a question for Commissioner Quiros, the number 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Deborah's calling in from Meriden. Deborah, what's your question?
Good morning, Commissioner. I have a question. I understand the importance of mask wearing for staff and your resident population. However, there are times when they're being asked to remove their staff, such as during strip searches after their legal visits, specifically when they squat and cough. Is there a reason you would ask them to remove that mask while coughing?
Yes. So we're very concerned with the COVID-19. And there's a balancing act that we have to maintain social safety and security inside a correctional facility. So we will not deviate from our policies when it comes to a strip search after a visit with contact with visitors. I have to make sure that policies are followed so that there's no breach of security happening. So that policy will remain in place.
Is that, I guess I can understand why Deborah is asking that question, Commissioner Quiros, this idea that that taking off masks during these strip searches, specifically when they cough, and is that concerning when we think about the way COVID is spread?
It is concerning. You are maintaining the 6 feet distance, and probably in some instance, based on the AP admission discharge room setting, you probably can even have 8 to 10 feet, but it's being done safely so that the offender is not coughing in the face of the staff member.
You mentioned visits. Let's start there. When we think about that, so many families weren't able to visit their loved ones during the peak of the pandemic. I understand that that has now started non-contact social visits as of October 15th. How is that going, and how are inmates and families able to see each other, considering you have to also be wary of social distancing?
So let me start by saying that as a commissioner, I believe that that family engagement, that family support plays an integral, huge part in the individual be successful out in the community. And it starts by those visits in a correctional settings. And I have to say that the offender population have been great in understanding the measures that we have taken to protect them and protect their loved ones. So on October 15, we started the first phase of non-contact visits in 11 out of the 14 correctional facilities. Because of the COVID uptick in Hartford CC, at Gardner CI in Newtown, and Osborne in summer, we've put those facilities in operational phase three, so there's no visits. We came in with a 50% reduction in capacity. The same procedures that a staff member entering a correctional facility goes through, with temperature checks and mask wearing, and then maintaining social distancing. The visits are pre-scheduled online. They'll email the contact person at each facility, and the visits will be established. That was important for me. I did not want to have, say, at New Haven CC, 100 family members showing up on day one in the lobby and not being able to maintain social distancing. So pre-schedule was the right way to go. The first 4 days of the visits, we had over 336 members that came in and saw their loved ones. This morning around 11 o'clock, I will receive the figures for the for the last week, and I'm hoping that it's a lot higher. It's been accepted with open arms by the inmate population. We're in the process of trying to finalize the social visits on teams. This was important for me that we provide an avenue for the population to see the loved ones in case that when COVID, second wave of COVID shuts down the whole state, that I'm providing them opportunity to visit with a loved one via Teams. This is a free to the inmate population, free to the family members. I thought that was important for me. I can easily went with the vendor and started up the tablets and had visits during the tablets, but that's gonna be a cost to the family, to the loved ones. So to me, I thought that the free route was better. One thing COVID-19 did for the Department of Correction, it exposed us on the lack of technology that we have in corrections. So right in June, mid-June, we started going into the 14 correctional facilities and wiring up each facility so that we can enhance the technology to take advantage of the technology, was in particular the social visits and more video conferences for the courts, for the public defender's offices. So, So I'm hoping that by the end of November, I can be real close, or if not by the end of November, have a couple facilities up on the video visitation.
You're talking about free video visitation for inmates and relatives to speak to each other. Again, you're hearing Commissioner Angel Quiroz. He leads the State Department of Correction. We'll continue talking with him after the break. You can join our conversation as well, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil, broadcasting remotely. Today, my guest is Department of Correction Commissioner Angel Quiroz. Governor Lamont nominated him to this position last month, and the Connecticut General Assembly is expected to take up his nomination during the regular session that starts in January. You can join our conversation, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Commissioner Quiroz, we talked about the second wave starting up here in our state, and naturally there are people in the community that would like to see their loved ones possibly released early, especially if they're non-violent offenders. You talked about discretionary releases a little bit earlier, but Deborah wanted to know, is there any reason why those eligible for parole within the next several months, which also includes flu season, can't be released early to aid in the control and elimination of COVID in the DOC system?
So from the onset, in March, we were very careful on our releases as far as we were not going to jeopardize public safety. We were not going to jeopardize public health. We were going to maintain the process that were in place and expedite the process. When it comes to compassionate release, just want to be clear so that the audience understands my responsibility in the DOC. My responsibility in the DOC is to identify the individuals that will be reviewed by our medical, one of our doctors, to figure if he or she is eligible as far as medical. You know, can we provide the medical attention that this individual needs based on the stage of the illness he or she may be experiencing? If the answer is yes, then that package is forward to BOPP, the Board of Pardons and Parole, where the chairperson and his committee will review the packages, the information, and then have a hearing, and then they are the ones to make the decision on releasing individuals out into the community. Based on my statutory authority, I did grant to 299 offenders a 90-day reentry furlough to get them closer to those release dates to TS, transitional supervision, out in the community.
I understand that 7 out of 10 inmates within our state prison system are Black or Hispanic. And when we think about discretionary release, how are your decisions and those involved helping to reduce racial disparities? This idea that maybe more inmates that are being granted discretionary release who are white versus those who are people of color, Commissioner?
I've heard that statement been mentioned before, and I'm a data-driven individual, so I went to the data on these individuals, the 4,300 that we released, and it mirrors the numbers of the individuals coming into the system. 65% of the releases were individuals that were people of color, and another 33% were white individuals, and then another 1 or 2% were Asian and Native American. So that mirrored exactly at the front end of the system. However, as a commissioner, I have a responsibility and a duty to make sure that I'm taking a look at our policies and procedure to make sure that that we're not contributing to those biases based on policies and procedures that that we have in place. Mm-hmm.
I mentioned that you were named interim commissioner back in the summer, and you've been working for the DOC, I believe, for 30 years. When you look at the way our state prison system has changed in the last few decades, just looking at population alone, you know, there are many people of color that are within those prisons. And I'm wondering, as you look to your nomination being confirmed in the General Assembly next year, what do you see your role as commissioner? Do you see yourself as a reformer?
So let's, criminal justice reform is here. And I was very upfront during the interview process that I need to be at the table when it comes to criminal justice reform. In order to make some changes to these inadequacies, we have to review policies that have been in place for 20, 30 years since I've been in the agency, and see what changes are necessary to be at the table. But I definitely want to be at the table. You say I came in 1989 when the basically, it was lock them up and throw away the key. There was no funding from programmings, and the citizens of the state of Connecticut did not want these individuals back out in the community. The politicians did not want these individuals in the community. They were victimizing individuals. Then in 2003, there was a shift. They started noticing that these individuals were coming back out into society and wanted correction to reinvest in these individuals. And that's when we started with the reentry piece, reintegration back into the community in order for them to be successful. And it was at that point that we started seeing more funding for programmings. And here we are in 2020 with criminal justice reform, which I believe that, and I stated at the beginning that I want to be at the table. I want to bring changes into corrections. I want to bring changes to the inmate population. I want to provide them with a skill set and opportunity for them to be successful out in the community. And definitely want to be at the table because we have to do this the right way. There's no shortcuts. There's no fast track. It's got to be well thought out and for the safety of the offender population and for the safety of our staff. It's got to be well thought out. But I believe that we will be at that table, and I'm looking forward for my confirmation so we can get that job started.
When you talk about changes within the prison system to help inmates reenter, what do you mean? What are some of the changes you'd like to see as commissioner so that recidivism is lower, so that when people are released, they have are able to get a job and a good place to live, Commissioner?
The best example I can give you prior to COVID, I had A offenders that were out on a work furlough program that worked for Witchcraft up in Ashford, Connecticut. These are manufacturing jobs. So I would sign off on their work furlough. A staff member would escort them, say around 2 o'clock, they'll start to leave from Summers, the Willis-Cybulski facility, they'll travel to Ashford, Connecticut. They work the whole second shift and come back. These individuals, when they were discharging, were discharging with job offers up to $50,000 a year to start. To me, that's what I'm looking at. Those are meaningful opportunity, a skill set that we can provide to our population. So when they're out there, they have a better opportunity to succeed. I look at Michigan DOC, the Villages, which is a vocational manufacturing school inside a correctional facility, and where there's classroom activities, there's collaboration with owners, manufacturer owners out in the community, and they bring the hands-on inside the correctional facility. I'm looking at hopefully to be able to have reallocate some of my line item savings into such program where I can bring the same concept into the Connecticut Department of Correction and provide the population with a skill set. Prior to COVID, when I would go on the Department of Labor's website, there was a lot of jobs opening when it came to manufacturing. And Connecticut was making a comeback in the manufacturing, and the owners were actually seeking and encouraging people to enter that field. So I think that's a big opportunity for Connecticut and for this population to take advantage of. And again, meaningful skill set to land a great job.
When we talk about savings, one way to do that is to continue to close prisons in our state. I understand the state's total prison and jail population is 9,534. That's a 31-year low. I'm getting those numbers from the governor's office. And so as commissioner, which prisons would you look to close next if we see, the number of inmates that are markedly lower than in previous decades?
So let me be clear, there will be facility closures in the upcoming budget year 21-22 and 22-23. What I will not do as a commissioner is inform the media what facilities are closing prior to me getting in my vehicle and driving to the facility and talking to the staff face-to-face, letting them know that the facility closure is happening, and then going out to the media. Facility closures are difficult to do. Based on my experience, I've been involved probably 5 to 6 facility closures. So I know that if you don't do it right, there can be, it can be very difficult. So I want to make sure that we do it right. I want to make sure that the staff are informed prior to me going out to the media, making it publicly. But I've been transparent with the unions. I've been transparent with the staff members when I visit the facilities that there will be facility closures. My focus right now is to get through the second wave of COVID of 2019 and making sure that the offender population is healthy, making sure that the our staff members stay healthy. I have spoken to the governor and my boss, and those conversations should start early March of 2021. And at that point, I will make it public. But there will be several facility closures. Mm.
You're hearing Commissioner Angel Quiros. He leads the Department of Correction. If you have a question, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I understand what you're saying, Commissioner, that you want to be thoughtful in this process, talking with staff to figure out which facility should close. I am curious about your plans for Northern. This is the maximum security prison. I understand you were warden there for a few years. That's an example of a prison where its population is down significantly, but there are also issues with the conditions at that prison. I believe a judge mentioning the smell of sewage within that prison, plumbing issues. I'm just curious if you could talk about a Northern in this possible potential closures in the future and the need for having a place like this anymore.
Yes, so that's the million-dollar question that I'm faced with when it comes to Northern. I will tell you this, so there's 4 facilities which I cannot close. So I cannot close your correctional institution. That's the only female prison. And I cannot close the three county jails, Hartford, New Haven, and Bridgeport, because that's for the unsentenced population. Every other facility is on the every other facility is on the book for me to review and for me to make a determination of which facility closures I'm going to make. I'm listening to everybody. I'm listening to the staff. I'm listening to the advocacy groups. I'm listening to the elected officials. Just listen to everybody. I take it in. As a commissioner, I must listen to our staff. I must listen to those advocacy groups. I must listen to the elected official and then make a decision. Northern came in online in 1994, where we were experiencing disturbances, riots, serious assault on staff. And when we opened it up, when we opened up Northern, I think the last disturbance was in 1995 at Carl Robinson, when we had two offenders that that were murdered on that compound. So Northern has served a critical it's served a critical role for us to maintaining safety and security at all of our 14 correctional facilities. However, as a commissioner, now I have to make that decision when I'm reviewing every facilities to see which facilities will be closed.
Let's take some listener calls for DOC Commissioner Angel Quiros. Again, you can join us. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Leroy's calling from New Haven. Leroy, are you there? Leroy, can you hear me?
Yes, I am, ma'am.
Yes, could you quickly ask your question to the commissioner?
Yes. My question is, because Osborne Correctional Jail is known for being unprofessional and displaying abuse of people's civil rights, while presently, pending lawsuits that are existing have not been resolved. I want to know if they're selling the people the face masks. If a person can't afford a face mask, do they throw them in seg? My other question is, are prisoners being made, to experience pre-COVID physical suffering symptoms and charge $3 and only being given Motrins, which is supposed to be the DOC cure-all drug?
Commissioner, so the first question, he wants to know if inmates have to pay for their own masks, and if they don't have a mask, what happens to them?
So inmates are not paying for the masks. Masks are free to the inmate population. We went into an agreement with the ACLU of providing two free masks, I believe is either weekly or biweekly for the inmate population. So there's no charge for offenders to wear masks. As far as co-payment, early on in the COVID first wave, we suspended co-payment for individuals. So individuals have not been paying that $3 co-payment since March of 2020. As we continue in the second wave, I have no desire to make the offended population start paying for the co-payment. You know, we're encouraging individuals to wear the mask. You know, both staff and offender population. The last place I want an individual to end up is in restrictive housing unit for not wearing a mask. You know, so I'd be more than happy for your listeners, if they have any names of this happened to look for me to look, give me the opportunity to look further into the allegations, because there's usually three sides to each story. As far as the unprofessional conduct, I have no desire to supervise staff that are going to be unprofessional to this population. I will be harsh with the discipline for unprofessional conduct. At the end of the day, 93% of this population currently here today, over 9,000, 93% will be back out in the communities, in society, at the grocery stores, at the school functions, at the mall. I want my correctional staff to be professional and have a professional interaction with this human dignity and preparing these individuals to enter society and be successful and be successful. So that's what I try to every opportunity I have when it's training or talking to the correctional staff is I want you to treat these individuals like human beings.
I want to take another quick call. Marie's calling in from Meriden. Marie, you're on the show. What's your question?
Hi. Data shows that the family contact visits are not luxury. Human touch helps reduce anxiety, stress, and blood pressure, leading to less disciplinary action reports. This ultimately helps to help the staff. Why is the Connecticut behind in our country on the expansion of family contact visits and in the fact we're putting up more barriers? What are you willing to do to change this?
Commissioner?
I didn't get the first part of the question, so...
I think she was just talking about how family contact is important for mental health as well, and she wants to know if you can work on improving family contact within for inmates and their families. She said that Connecticut is behind other states in this.
Absolutely. I think I said it before that to me, it's very important for the population that we supervise to maintain contact with a loved one while they're incarcerated. It's a great support system. It does reduce stress for the individuals. We have, prior to COVID, we went into two correctional facilities, York and Willis-Cybulski, and made that visiting room more family-oriented, where we brought in toys for the kids to play with while they're working, having their visits with the loved ones. So we're moving towards towards that direction where we can improve the overall quality of those engagement with the families.
I wanted to ask you before we run out of time, Commissioner Quiros, you know, early on, the State Department of Correction was isolating those inmates who had gotten sick with COVID. They were sent, I believe, up to Northern. That has changed, but I wanted you just to update us on that, because as we talk about the second wave, you know, we anticipate more people in our communities will get sick, including within your prisons.
Yes, it was very important for us, the DOC and the administration, to learn the data, the information that we learn about the COVID-19. Back in March 2020, there was not one correctional agency throughout the United States that really understood how deadly COVID-19 was gonna be. We started following CDC guidelines, DPH guidelines. When the guidelines came and say that you had to separate a symptomatic individual, we knew that we had to make a medical isolations room. So at that time, the best place to go was Northern. There was four empty housing units. We didn't have to move population around and contribute to the spread at the facilities for moving the individuals. So the decision was made to go to Northern. Once COVID was over, once COVID declined back in June, gave us the opportunity when we're touring the facility, talk to the inmate population that became positive COVID cases. And what I got back was a lot of them were scared and hiding their symptoms to go to Northern. So what that did is contributed to the spread of the COVID-19 because the offenders are hiding their symptoms. Prior to Commissioner Cook leaving, the decision was already made that we were moving away from Northern. And he provided me with the direction to find a new location for this medical isolation unit. And when I took over as the interim commissioner, once I was introduced by the governor, I think within 10 days, I moved the medical isolation out of Northern, and it's at McDougal Walker. It's in a better setting, medical unit right on site in the housing unit, all cell, and provides me with the safeguards for the CDC guidelines on how to house a symptomatic individual.
Again, you've been hearing Commissioner Angel Quiros here on Where We Live. He is the commissioner of the State Department of Correction. I think the official title is Commissioner Designate because your nomination still needs to be confirmed by the Connecticut General Assembly. And we appreciate your time today answering our questions as well as our listeners, Commissioner. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we're going to talk to Kellen Lyons, who's been covering the State Department of Correction. And you can join us too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We just heard from the commissioner of the State Department of Correction, Commissioner Angel Quiros. Connecticut Mirror's Kellen Lyons has been covering the DOC, and he joins us now on Zoom. Welcome back to the show, Kel.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to respond to what Commissioner Quiros shared. I guess starting with, it was an interesting call from a listener about After visitation, inmates have to undergo strip searches, and I believe the listener was saying that they're having to take the mask off and cough. That seems problematic when we think about how COVID is spread.
Yeah, that stuck out to me as well. I've heard a decent amount from folks inside and family members about conditions regarding masks. This is an executive order issued by the governor that correction officers and those who can't practice social distancing have to wear a mask, but not if they're able to practice social distancing. So I've talked to the commissioner before about how correction officers, there's a progressive discipline structure if they violate that executive order. But if a correction officer is, say, walking through a hallway and they are not within 6 feet of others, whether it's their correction officer peer, medical staff, or an incarcerated person, they don't have to wear that mask. So if they are unable to practice social distancing and they do it and they are not wearing a mask, they will have like a talking to from the warden of that prison, and then they'll be shown the executive order, and then, you know, eventually they can be written up. The last that I talked to the commissioner, nobody had been written up or disciplined or suspended because of the mask use, and that was about 6 weeks ago. But I've heard some conflicting reports about whether or not everybody is wearing them inside, and as we all know, it's quite difficult to practice social distancing in the state correctional facilities.
At the end of the interview, we talked about how they are now sending people who are sick with COVID to McDougal. And I'm just wondering how that's been going, this isolated unit at McDougal versus a Northern, which was problematic from the beginning.
Yeah, that's a big change. The commissioner acknowledged in his, the announcement of his nomination that they had found that incarcerated folks were hiding their symptoms to avoid being sent to Northern. It's quite significant they're not sending them to Northern anymore because of medical isolation. A lot of guys inside were worried about not getting access to mail or being held in the more isolating facility over up at Northern. I haven't heard recently about folks hiding their symptoms in the same way, but also a lot of that was due to the lack of mass testing at the time earlier in the pandemic. It was perhaps easier for incarcerated folks to hide those symptoms because they weren't being tested as regularly. Now it seems as though there's not as much fear about being sent over to the most secure prison in the state, since Northern is now off the table, at least for the medical isolation unit.
I understand the DOC latest numbers are there are 107 offenders who have tested positive for COVID-19. 8 are symptomatic. And I'm wondering again if we could talk through when we think about the mass testing. Commissioner Quiros mentioned that a few times, but I believe that was the result of a settlement with the ACLU. Can you provide the context there?
Yeah, so the ACLU reached a settlement with their federal lawsuit with the Department of Correction several months ago. There were a lot of provisions in there regarding access to soap, PPE. The department would have to prioritize certain incarcerated people for discretionary release provisions. The mass testing was a piece of the ACLU settlement. And so they've gone through, I think, two or three rounds, and they're beginning a new one, as the commissioner said, in 2 days on Wednesday. So that the DOC will say that that's a huge help as far as identifying cases and trying to isolate folks who wind up getting virus and figuring out their quarantining protocols and such.
We spent some time talking about his plans on future closures of facilities, and you know, he said that he couldn't get into that right now. But I wanted you to talk through with your reporting. He mentioned Northern, but some other potential prisons that may be on that list come 2021.
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting. He was talking about how there are four that are that he cannot close, and he identified York, which is the state's only women's prison, and then the county jails, Hartford, New Haven, and Bridgeport. Those are the primarily house the unsentenced population, and those tend to have the biggest churn, people coming in and out. But he did not mention Manson Youth Institution, which is a prison that houses the youngest people in the prison system, including children. There's about on any given day, there's around 50 or so kids, meaning under 18, who are incarcerated at Manson. And that's a prison that was under investigation by the Department of Justice for its conditions of confinement for children. And the state's three branches of government are in the process of hashing out an idea for the next legislative session on how to take pre-sentenced kids out of the adult system. So that would take a bunch of children out of the adult system and leave the sentenced kids. And if you cut, you know, any number from 50, you're spitting distance from getting all of the children out of the system entirely. So it stuck out to me that was not one that he had mentioned, simply because he did say closure. So he mm-hmm. he used the plural. So it appears as though Manson is not the only one that's potentially on the chopping block. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you how correction officers within the state prison system, how do they view Commissioner Quiros? Again, he's someone that's come up through the system. He's worked there for 30 years at least. And I'm just wondering, in terms of what his management style is, do they respect him? And how do you foresee these negotiations going in the future when they think about closing more prisons?
Yeah, the corrections unions seem to like him. I mean, he came up from, he worked his way from the bottom on up. He started 31 years ago. He started as a CO, and now he's up at the top of the system. I mean, he knows the systems quite well. He spent his whole career here in Connecticut, so he knows how to talk with the unions in a way that perhaps the previous commissioner was less adept at. And I think that they are wary of the closures. I mean, I think Northern specifically is seen by a lot of different things by a lot of different people. The corrections officers, the ones that I've talked to, have said that they see Northern's function as adaptable. You know, it's a place that houses some of the people who commit acts of violence, as well as some of the folks who were sick during COVID. Advocates see it as this place that is just really dehumanizing. It exacerbates mental health conditions. But it seems as though a lot of the correction officers see Northern as a viable tool for them to try to help deter violence in the prison system. They argue that it's a system of deterrence to try to keep folks from committing acts of violence against correction officers or their incarcerated peers. I think that that's the looming fight that's coming up, is whether or not the unions are. What negotiations are going to have to happen between the unions to get these facilities to close? The commissioner has told me that that this is such a delicate dance, because you're messing with the routine of those who are in the union. You know, folks who put their loved ones on the bus, their kids on the bus every morning before they go to school, or they have a longer commute, or their shift starts at a different time, or they, you know, they're just operating from a place of comfort where they've worked in those facilities for such a long time. So I think that that's going to be among the biggest challenges that he's facing as he tries to figure out which to close.
Kellen Lyons, again, is a criminal justice and mental health reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. He does great work covering departments like the Department of Correction. We'll be sure to link to your many stories at Where We Live. Kel, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today's show produced by Tess Terrible. Again, thanks to our other producer, Carmen Baskoff, on the phones today. Our tech producer is Kat Pastor. We'll be back tomorrow.